You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Madonna's Fall from Grace, a one-way ticket to Syria, cold calling, and we review Reinventing the Royals.
Hello everybody, welcome back to the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. We call it the Parish Council. I'm Magnus Shaw. And hey girls, do you believe in love? Well, he's got something to say about it. He's Terence Dackham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello.
And I've found a new definition, Magnus Shaw, how to confirm you're definitely getting old. Staying up till 5 a.m. on Monday morning to watch the Oscars, but still feeling the effects on Friday morning. That's my definition of feeling old. I don't know how Keith Richards manages that lifestyle.
I can have a good guess.
yes. I don't have the pharmaceuticals
no,
to
no,
go
No, that's right. No, or more fool you staying up till all hours watching the Oscars. You don't want to be doing that.
No, I probably don't. What a week for news, though, Magnus Shaw. And an intriguing story concerning your Guardian.
Oh, again, yes.
Yeah, right. Yes. You know, people travelling through, I don't know if you saw this story, but people travelling through London Bridge Railway Station on Monday were handed a beautifully crafted, hand-drawn version of an edition of Your Guardian from 4 years ago. And not just the front page, the whole newspaper, hand-drawn, complete with redrawn photographs and advertisements and the lot.
Yes.
And BuzzFeed picked up on this, and they've spent the week investigating and discovered that this was something of an elaborate art prank by the artist Charlotte Mann. Mm-hmm. And I really love this. 3,000 copies of, you know, the entire newspaper, hand-drawn.
Really?
Yes, 3,000 copies were distributed by art students in the London Bridge area on Monday. Charlotte Mann said the whole point was to confuse people, and she certainly succeeded. Mm. However, a lot of people have given feedback that because of the reproduction process in the printing, the text is quite hard to read. And, of course, that's exactly the problem with the normal edition of The Guardian.
Quite hard to read. Yeah, how long does it take to hand-draw 3,000 copies of The Guardian? And why one from 4 years ago? Why not yesterday's?
I'm aching to know more about this. The story is only
perhaps it took 4 years to draw 3,000.
Possibly it did. Possibly it did. What an extraordinary thing to do. I love things like that. You know, performance art with no purpose whatsoever.
No,
absolutely wonderful. Yeah. Now, Magnus Shaw.
That's me.
I've been to the Brits extravaganza a few times and generally found it too noisy in particular, too backslappy, too corporate for my taste. I was there the year John Prescott copped a bucket of iced water.
That was you and Dan But No Bacon.
The Chumbawamba fella, yeah. I wasn't too far away on that one. And the trouble was sort of widely unreported, was that, yes, Prescott got, you know, a bit damp, but it was poor Mrs. Prescott that copped... Yeah, Pauline, who really copped the lot and was absolutely frightened by the whole thing. I mean, that was the... Yes, exactly. You know, it's okay making your political protest, but it was poor Pauline Prescott that, you know, really seemed to get the vast majority of the contents of that
bucket. You'll remember Pauline Prescott used to have a car to take her from the hotel to the Labour Party conference so her hair didn't get blown about.
So a distance of some 50 yards, I think.
I know. It's a woman of the people, I think.
Yes, exactly. Also, I was also there when Ronnie Wood had a punch-up with Brandon Block.
Oh, God, that's right, yeah.
But when the invitations came through for this year's event, something I must say that I kind of regret this now, held on Wednesday, of course, when I was, as we know, still recovering from staying up at the Oscars, you know, I respectfully declined and asked, oh no, what did I miss? Because, you see, the thing is, I didn't want to miss Wolf Hall either, as well, you know, as it was on Wednesday.
Quite so, exactly, yes.
But look at what I missed, Magnus Shaw. Ed Smith. Ed Smith and Sam Sheeran.
Yes.
winning lots of awards, and most crucially, Madonna falling down some stairs.
Yeah, I was just saying to a friend of mine yesterday, I thoroughly enjoyed the fall at the Brit Awards.
The newspapers have been full of pictures and stories of Madonna's spectacular fall. But the thing is, I don't like the crowing and the pointing. I always feel terribly sorry when someone falls over, and I don't see the humour in it. Of course, we have to put that in the context of me being extraordinarily pompous and almost entirely humourless. But Magnus Shaw, someone falling over isn't funny.
Oh, I think it has been designated funny, hasn't it, for decades, centuries, really. From Buster Keaton to Vic Reeves, people falling over has been a comic staple, hasn't it? But when somebody actually falls over, yes, it's quite considered. And Miss Ciccone went over with a hell of a bang, didn't she? I immediately wound it back, thanks to the magic of digital television, and watched it a couple of times, and she really went down with a slam there. Yes, yeah. So until you establish that somebody's okay, then yeah, of course it's not funny. It's a potential injury. If somebody stuck themselves with a sharp knife, you wouldn't roll about laughing, would you? So I do take your point, but yeah, unfortunately, falling over has been a slapstick staple for as long as anybody can remember.
I think there's a difference between real life and your Buster Keaton and your sort of silent comedies, yeah, where they sort of fall over,
yeah,
and
Pratt's Falls, I think they're called,
yeah,
aren't they? Yeah,
so I think there's a difference. By the way, yes, she really did go down with a bang. Tracy Thorn was close to the front. She was there to report back for the New Statesman, and she said that it was the sound of the clunk of the microphone on the floor,
right,
that really gave her cause for concern, because it was an almighty clatter in the hall, and there was real concern. Mm. But what a trooper, Dr. Footlights, yeah, stepped in, didn't he? And she was up continuing the song with her, the cape dangling.
She was, yeah. I mean, I think that she was rattled. I think it sort of put the kibosh on the rest of the number. But yeah, she completed it. That's fair. I would not want to have been one of the dancers backstage immediately afterwards, though.
No, they might have got the full force of the Madonna
to say
the tongue, mightn't they? Yes. Magnus Shaw, I look to the world of science, because, as we've established before, you can never, ever disagree with science.
No.
I looked to the world of science for an explanation, and I was delighted to find through Scientific American magazine that Stanford University has a psychiatrist and laughter researcher.
I wonder who funds him.
Yes. Yeah. It's a Mr. William F. Fry, and Mr. Fry writes about the different reaction to someone falling from, say, a 10-story building and dying, and someone walking down the street and tumbling over a paving stone. And essentially they're the same thing, but our reactions are different. This is what Fry says. He reckons that our brains trigger a mirror response to what we see in life. Mm. So if the 10-story fall, we empathise with the seriousness. But the 3-inch fall, we identify with the embarrassment of the faller. Mm-hmm. And our brain gets tickled by neurons firing.
Yeah.
So fair enough if you laughed at Madonna's fall from grace. It was just your neurons being tickled.
I didn't laugh. I was just, almighty surprised. Because the whole thing had nearly wrapped up, and it was starting to wash over one a little bit, wasn't it?
I didn't watch it.
Okay, right. No. It was, so close to the end. You thought, well, we've seen it, done it. So, your curiosity was pricked because it was Madonna's return to the stage and so on and so forth. But I have to admit, I was watching it out of one eye, perhaps. And one could say that that was just what was required for Madonna to jump start your reactions by falling over backwards like that. But and Mrs. Well, Magnus Shaw let out an audible, oh, she went.
She empathised. You see, she empathised.
Yeah, and I said, oh, what?
That's because I've said before, Mrs. Magnus Shaw, she's all right by me. See, she's a decent person.
Right.
Now, some people, though, Magnus Shaw, now you watch the guy, I've only seen a kind of YouTube-y type clip.
Yeah.
But some people, and I don't give this much credibility, some people are saying she did it deliberately because, career not going too well and, boosting the sales of the new product.
Yeah.
It was all staged.
No, I can say with some confidence that wasn't the case. Just from the sheer fact that she was clearly rattled for a good 30 seconds to a minute after it happened. And you could just, I mean, subtle body language told you that everybody was quite taken aback. That wasn't built into it. I'm not having that. I can see why people might think that, but and I think, you know, Madonna would believe that beneath her anyway, a stunt like that. No,
I would have hoped so.
You can see how it happened. She was struggling to get the neck clasp from the cape away from her throat at the point that the dancers received their cue to pull the cape away. That's what happened. But she really went over with a hell of a bang. And I'm sure she's got a bit of a bruised body as we speak. So we shouldn't laugh at people being injured.
That's my overriding point.
I didn't laugh. I mean, have you ever fallen over in public? Have you ever experienced that ignominy?
Yes, I've done that thing where, you trip over a paving stone and then you stumble forward. And then you try and convert it into a little run.
I think we should all take our cues from cats, shouldn't we? If you ever see a cat slip off the arm of a chair or stumble like that, they regain their composure in a nanosecond. They're very, very good at it.
We could learn a lot from okay, so yeah, that's one of the lessons from the week, is learning the power of Velcro.
You'd think with all the resources available to Madonna, there would have been a catch on that cape that just came free at the slightest tug, wouldn't you?
You're absolutely right, because pantomime is built on such products. The quick change routines on the stage, legendary. And also, funnily enough, I'm reading Amy Poehler's book at the moment, and she talks about on Saturday Night Live about, obviously, it being live, and the quick changes that they have to do, suits being ripped off and other clothing being put on in the space of 10 seconds. And yet Madonna clearly hadn't learned.
It was clearly built into the routine that she was to undo her own cape. I don't see why it couldn't have just been a pull free affair. It's very, very curious there. So I would have thought the costume designer would have been in for a little talking to.
I think their ears are probably burning more than those dancers. But another story that's hard to ignore from this week is the tale of the three girls from London who took a plane from Gatwick to Turkey and are now believed to have crossed the border into Syria to join up with ISIS. By the way, on a side issue, I just thought of this morning. Now that we know the name of the murderer of so many hostages, could all be media stop referring to him as Jihadi John? It makes a barbarian into a cartoon character.
I agree, yes. And when there were four of them, who they were trying to identify, and they gave them the Beatles names. I genuinely thought, well, if I was Yoko Ono or Olivia Harrison, I would have been outraged by that.
I mean, it was gallows humour, wasn't it? Of some of the hostages, because there were four of them and they were from England, some of the thing, I think the hostages from America referred to them as the Beatles, just to, as you say, literally gallows humour.
Obviously, if you're being held by those monsters, then anything to bring you a sliver of relief is acceptable. But for the media to then take up the cudgels and start referring to these three, four appalling men by the names of two people who are still alive and two people who are remembered with affection, I thought was in appalling taste.
Absolutely. I don't know why they keep perpetrating it. The three girls that we were just talking about there, Khadija Sultana, Shamima Begum, Amira Mirabath, they're schoolgirls who've left their families and somehow managed to get to Syria without the British authorities, the airline, or the Turkish authorities getting in their way. I've noticed two trains of thought on this issue during the week. Writing in The Guardian, Nosheen Iqbal refers to the three as vulnerable children, whilst in The Independent, Grace Dent takes the view that these girls knew what they were doing and there should be no way for them to return. And so this led me to wonder that if a young member of your family suddenly turned up in news footage crossing the border to Syria, what would you do? Would you understand that they could never return, or would you take a more conciliatory route?
It has to be hypothetical, doesn't it? Because I don't see I mean, not just because a member of my family wouldn't do that, but the general scenario that you paint has to be hypothetical. So I don't see how they could be retrieved unless they volunteered to come back. If they wish to come back, I think it's highly unlikely they'd be allowed to. All that said, yes, if there was a route back for them, if they were located and somehow provision could be made for them to come back, yes, of course they should be brought back. The law defines them as children.
Exactly,
the eldest is 16 and the youngest 14, I think. And at that age, I think it is absolutely absurd to say they knew exactly what they were doing. At 14, did you understand the complexities and the implications of world events in that way? I think they've been groomed and seduced and to a certain extent brainwashed, whatever brainwashed means, but persuaded to do something that I'm sure as we speak they are bitterly regretting, because whatever they found when they have arrived in Syria, assuming they haven't, the evidence seems pretty good that they have made it over the border from Turkey. Whatever they have found will be manifestly different from what they were expecting to find. And the adventure on which they thought they were embarking will have turned out to be something far more sinister than an expedition to a foreign place. I feel desperately sorry for them. I don't think it will end well. I don't think there's a way back for them, but if there was, we should ensure that it is there for them to take. We can spend a lot of time once they're back here in some way deprogramming them. After all, if somebody becomes involved in what we would view as a sinister cult of some sort, we make great efforts, or at least families do, make great efforts to extricate them from that group, lest they come to some sort of harm. I don't see any difference. And of course, the girls of that age should be given every opportunity to come home and find some safety and sanctuary away from something that I wouldn't want to expose anybody of any age, but particularly children, to. But unfortunately, I don't think that option is available, because I can't see any way that they will find a route back.
Now, you refer to their young ages, and you may be right with the 14-year-old, but most of the media says there's two 15-year-olds and a 16-year-old, but I mean that's possibly a doubt about their exact ages. But both pieces to which I referred have the same slightly grainy photo from CCTV showing the girls going through security at Gatwick. On a more general note, and talking about the sort of vulnerability of young people, I think it would be helpful to try and understand, to know how watching people being murdered, or perhaps viewing a gay man being hurled to his death from a tower, encourages these young people to think, oh yes, that's the life for me. That's the bit I can't understand. We talk about radicalization and brainwashing and grooming.
Yes.
And the other day, David Hepworth wrote on his blog, he wrote about this, David's wife is a teacher, and he was talking about the school from which these girls came, and David wondered if this is simply a new way for teenagers to rebel. He says it was always this way, and he quoted Marlon Brando way back in the 50s in the film The Wild One. Brando says, what am I rebelling against? What have you got?
Exactly, yes. Quite so. I think at that age, just so post-puberty, whatever upsets adults the most is what we'll be attracted to, whether that's buying a copy of Nevermind the Bollocks or going to become a jihadi bride in Syria. The marked difference, of course, is that buying a copy of Nevermind the Bollocks is a relatively benign act, and going out to Syria may be the end of your life. But I think the impulse, I think David's right, I think the impulse is probably the same one, is that it's the most rebellious thing one can think of doing. If you're disenfranchised at home, or at least disenchanted at home, your parents have told you you have to be in at 10 and you want to come in at 10:30, all that kind of stuff, then you think, well, what's the spikiest thing I can do? This is an extreme example, I have to say. I can only begin to guess what it is like at the age of 15 to fly yourself to Turkey and associate yourself with some of the most dubious characters one could ever wish to meet and be transported over the border to some kind of anarchic, sadist death cult. I don't know about 15, but certainly at 14, I figured a train journey down to London and back was pretty edgy stuff, you know. So, yeah, down at 15, I think, to go down to London from Nottingham was pretty edgy stuff. In the full knowledge that I would be back in my bed the day after. So what that experience must be like, I do not. And the fact that they managed to achieve it, that nobody at any point intervened and said, where do you think you're going? All just adds to the horror of the situation. And I can only begin to guess where they are now and what is happening to them.
Like you said earlier, I think it's fair to say it probably won't end well.
No, but to point to them and say they deserve everything they get, we don't want them back here, and they are some kind of ISIS youth and therefore our enemy, is so lacking in compassion and insight and concern that it makes me feel rather queasy.
It reminded me, in some ways, a sort of super amplified version of Unity Mitford back in the late 1930s, heading off to sort of hang out with Hitler, thinking he was the best thing ever. Ill advised.
Well, we are at that age attracted to dark, edgy figures, and we don't even know that these girls watched beheading videos. All we know is that they were contacted and invited to come and do this thing, and of course the terms in which that invitation was couched would have been very persuasive. They may well have been told that the beheadings were propaganda from the West, and we don't do that sort of thing. Who knows what they were told? But if there is any way back, we of course should bring them back. Of course we should.
Okay, I have a family member who reaches out as the phone rings 3 or 4 times a day, cheerfully hoping it's a son, daughter, grandchild calling up for a chat, only for her to be told that she's eligible for compensation for a road accident, a discount on home improvement, or a repayment for PPI. Cold calling, the curse of the modern age. Spam for the ears. I was quite lucky with my ex-directory phone number in that I tend to escape this whole business. I maybe only receive a handful a year. But from April of this year, the law is being changed to make it easier to impose huge fines on the companies behind these calls. Have you had an accident that wasn't your fault, Magnus Shaw?
No, any accidents I've had was entirely my own fault, I think. It's interesting that you call it to the curse of the modern age, because I think there's something incredibly archaic about cold calling. I'm amazed it still goes on. It's so very annoying, but also, and I've got some insight into this, incredibly inefficient. The number of calls you have to make before somebody says, "Ooh, yeah, I think I will have you come round and measure up for double glazing, or advance my case for personal injury insurance, or whatever it happens to be." I'm astonished that it's worth that one in every 1,000 customers that you obtain from the process. Interestingly enough, I have on my pad in front of me here the words "spam for the ears," which is exactly what you just said down to me. So maybe we're onto something there. Even direct mail, which is a euphemism for junk mail, has a better uptake rate than cold calling. I'm also quite astonished that they can find anybody to do it. I mean, really, who wants to do that? Because you're going to hear a lot of expletives before you hear a warm and welcoming voice. It really is the equivalent of knocking on the door and inviting people to join your religion. But at least then you're motivated by the fact that you're going to be rewarded by your deity for doing it. This seems to have no little or no reward for doing it at all. So, I mean, I guess, you know, people need the job. But it's, I don't know, I don't know that it is of the modern age. It seems very, very old-fashioned way of advertising or marketing anything.
Because I'm ridiculously soppy, I do feel sorry for the people who have to make the calls.
Indeed,
must be awful. Fines of up to £500,000 on the way if the Information Commissioner's Office consider companies who break the rules cause, quote, substantial damage or substantial distress, end quote.
Yeah.
Of course, the thing is, because these calls are automated and numbers dialed at random, that telephone preference service thing is no good. Because
that's right. No, absolutely true, and it's not enforced anyway, because I am ex-directory on my landline and also on the telephone preference list, and I still get problematic calls offering all sorts of usually vitamins and minerals, and they try to persuade me that either myself or my wife have ordered vitamins and minerals in the past, and their records show that they must be running out by now and that it's dangerous to stop taking them.
Oh, well, Magnus, sure, if you're in danger, perhaps you should, you know, invite these people round.
Yeah, but we've never ordered any vitamins or minerals. But we get that one.
They'd be more successful if they were offering you 20 Rothmans, packets of
half-price fags. I'd engage them straight away, yeah. But, I get IT ones as well. And they're all hopelessly put together, you know. They usually mispronounce either my name or my wife's name, and if you don't know the correct name, then this can hardly be a valid call. And I hang up. I don't do the stuff that you hear reported as picking some choice expletive to recall the person, because they're sitting there miserable as sin having to do this for a living. So I don't do that, but I do say, please do not call this number again. And then if 2 hours later they call again, then I still don't swear, but I get a little bit more annoyed and say, make a note, do not ever call this number again. And I just think, you know, will you sell one package of magnesium tablets today? I can't see how you possibly will, but it seems magnificently inefficient and archaic and pointless, really.
I have a simple rule. I don't answer the phone to any number I don't recognise. I think if it's important, they'll leave a message. I don't know if it's going to sort of cost me dear in some time but I actually, if it's a, because, you know, I've got caller display, and everybody I know, it comes up with their name because it's attributed to a number.
This is on your landline, if it's just, is it?
And mobile. Okay. And if it's a number I don't recognise, I just simply put the phone on mute, don't answer it.
I don't have caller display on my landline. Oh. Obviously, I do on my mobile. So I sometimes get caught out. But when I do get really particularly annoyed by it is when they say it's a call for my daughter or for my wife. And I say, no, they're not interested, and you're not to call this number again. And they say, oh, we can't take you off our list until that person, you know, my daughter or my wife, has told us. And then I do lose it somewhat and say, this is my telephone. and when I instruct you not to use this line, then you'll take it from me. You do not need to hear it from anybody else. But it's all just
a game, isn't it? It's just a game.
It's a game, and really, I can be pretty certain that the results for the people initiating the game are shoddy, to say the least. I don't really know why they still do it.
Well, you know what, Magnus Shaw? We've now got another in our terrific series. Magnus Shaw tells us something in what you call, if you only do one thing this week, then do this.
Somebody remixed that jingle. It's sounding even better now.
It's
so fantastic. Yeah. Okay, well, this week I'm going to bring you something I would call, and others have called, a meta movie. I'm sure you're familiar with the notion of something being meta. There's self-referential, I think meta has come to mean, hasn't it? And this is a movie about...
I thought it meant that you liked it, but it really doesn't matter.
Oh, very good. Yes, yes, yeah. If you like, you can take it to mean that. But in this instance, it means self-referential, because this is a movie about people making a movie. And it's set in Italy in the 1970s, and it's about a man who is invited to Italy to make a cult Italian horror movie. And I know you're not particularly up to speed with horror movies, but in the 70s and early 80s, a lot of cult horror came out of Italy. The movie's called Barbarian Sound Studio, which is where the whole film is set. And the fellow who's invited out to work on this film is played by Toby Jones. Now, you will know Toby Jones.
Great.
Fantastic actor, fantastic actor. And he plays a Foley artist. Now, for anybody not familiar, Foley artists are the sound effects people. On any film, you watch anything from Close Encounters to 50 Shades of Grey, you will see in the credits Foley artists, and they are the people who add sounds after the film has been made. And they still do it largely the old-fashioned way. Some of it is now done digitally, but the old-fashioned way was to, if you have a character walking on gravel, then there'll be a tray of gravel mic'd up and somebody with the appropriate shoes marching up and down on top of it. And in Barbarian Sound Studio, because it's a cult horror movie, there's quite a lot of dismemberments and such like, and so there's a lot of fruit and vegetables in the sound studio, which are battered, chopped and knocked about to replicate body parts, and that is very much how it's still done. It's a great art, and it's fascinating to watch Foley artists at work. It's really remarkable to see what substances stand in for other substances. So a fire is much better replicated not by recording a fire, but by crushing cling film into a mic and such like. So Toby Jones is a Foley artist. He's invited out. He thinks he's going to work on a very innocent film about horses, and it turns out it's a really fairly hardcore horror movie that he's working on. And then things go slightly awry as he gets sucked into the people's world who are making this film, and it's the lines between the film they're making and the real world start to become very blurred. And I won't go much further, because you need to see it for yourself. What's great about this is a horror movie about a horror movie, but although the film that they're making is terribly gory, the film that you're watching isn't. It all rests on atmosphere and unease and hostility and just the idea of somebody completely out of their depth and going slightly crazy. There's no monsters, there's no vampires. Actually, there's no gore other than the implied gore. You never see a single frame of the film that they're making. We only see them seeing that. And the atmosphere is extraordinary, very dark, because they're in a sound studio. We never see daylight. And the people around Toby Jones become ever more menacing and odd as the film goes on. It is one of those films that leaves you pondering for days what it is that has exactly happened and what it is you've seen. It's completely original, a massively intelligent thriller, and beautifully really knows its subject matter. It really understands Foley artists and a cult Italian horror movie, strangely enough. And I can't recommend it highly enough, but it will leave you very unsettled and scratching your head a little bit and maybe lying awake a little longer than you normally do after watching a movie. It's available to stream, rent, or buy from Amazon and other places, and it's called Barbarian Sound Studio.
Okay, yes, as you say, if you're interested in Barbarian Sound Studio, it is available Amazon Instant Video, and on eBay, I noticed that you can currently get copies, so that's where to go if you would like to know more about that movie. The relationship between the British royal family and the media has for a long time now been a fractious one, ever since George VI tried to keep his stammer from being exposed by the media, through to some curious rumours about various members of the royal family and the current stories surrounding Prince Andrew. There's often been several degrees of frost between the royals and the Fourth Estate. over the last 2 weeks, Steve Hewlett on BBC Two's Reinventing the Royals has been examining if, in 2015, their air of suspicion still remains. How much sympathy do you feel for the royal family as they lead their lives in the glare of flashbulbs?
Well, there are degrees, aren't they? I mean, on the whole, I don't feel much sympathy. I think that's part of the deal. That's the trade-off, that we support them through our tax dollars, although not all of them, and far fewer of them than it used to be. But to a greater extent, we support them and keep them in that rather lavish lifestyle through tax payments. And in return, we get to look at them, prod them, poke them, wave them about, and attract tourists with them. Of course, there are lines to be drawn. And in this documentary, it was suggested only by one commentator, but in light of recent events, we can believe it, that press photographers shouting to Kate Middleton that she was a slag in order for her to look round angrily is, of course, unacceptable, just on a human level. You don't shout that to anybody for any reason, and particularly not to get a reaction and a photograph in a newspaper. But on the whole, the principle of the press reporting on the royal family seems to be part of the deal as far as I'm concerned. I mean, as you know, I'm a pure Republican, and I would say, if they dislike it so intensely, then there's a perfectly good solution, which is to dissolve themselves and we'll elect our leaders. Thank you very much. But lacking that eventuality there, and I think that on the whole, it's fair enough for them to be scrutinised by the press.
Penny Juno, it was who relayed what the paparazzi shout to get a reaction. And I have mentioned this before a long time ago, and it involves a little bit of name dropping, but I can sort of give that a great deal of credibility because I was talking once to Sienna Miller, and she told me and a few other people, having dinner with a few people, and she told me about at the sort of height of her fame in terms of tabloid recognition that paparazzi would be waiting at the end of her kind of, she lived in a kind of muse, and the paparazzi would be waiting at the end of that for her to come home of the evening, and then would chase her, literally chase her, to the point that she used to have to take her shoes off and run barefoot to get away from them. And they too would be yelling every horrible word and insult that you could possibly think to either provoke her or whoever was with her into reacting, so that the pictures in the next day's newspapers would be of, as they wish, Sienna Miller punching a photographer or screaming or reacting. That's what they were doing to Catherine Middleton.
Absolutely, and I only hope these gentlemen, in inverted, massive inverted commas, of Her Majesty's press can sleep well at night, knowing that they've earned their living in that fashion, because that's just disgraceful, and equally disgraceful if that's what they were doing to Kate Middleton. But the general principle of the press scrutiny, I mean, that's really what the royals are for, isn't it? Is to be exhibited, and we do that through the press, so I don't really have a problem with that. The programme, I thought, was, I don't know, it seemed to be all surface and no depth. There seemed to be a lot of, and then this happened, and then this happened. It seemed to be a chronology of the showdowns between the royals and the press, and the ways in which the reporting of the royal family has evolved in the media, rather than telling any intriguing stories about that relationship. I think we bounced across the surface a bit for me. So I felt a bit of a missed opportunity, a little bit like the House of Commons inside the Commons, in that we saw a lot, but did we learn a lot? A lot of the things mentioned in this particular program I already knew, and I think a lot of people did. Charles mumbling about how much he disliked Nicholas Witchell.
Can't blame him for that.
Well, you might say that. I couldn't possibly comment. But we knew that happened. And just to say that it happened again doesn't really bring us any closer to the subject matter. So I think a lot of it was just narrative rather than insight. That was my problem with this.
I felt that particularly in the first episode. This was the second of two. The first episode, I really did feel you're telling me things I already know and footage I've already seen countless times. I just want to return to the paparazzi business for a moment because, you know, do they behave so badly? About how many years ago would this be now? Four years ago, the One Direction year of X Factor.
Oh right, yeah, maybe three years.
I spent the day at Fountain Studios. In fact, I'm fairly sure I wrote.
I can remember you going down there,
Rocking Vicky. And I spent a fair bit of that time with the photographers who, with their little step ladders and various means of trying to get over the hoardings at Fountain Studios. And, you know, some behaved in a sort of benign fashion, but yes, some behaved appallingly. Again, just shouting out anything to, in particular, at the time, of course, your Harry Styles and your Zayns were unknowns. Yeah, but at the judges, mainly, and the female judges, to get them to turn round and react. And they don't hold back. They'll say anything. But I was thinking, what a contrast to another age, another sort of very minor bit of name dropping. When Prince William was at Ludgrove School in Wokingham, he went with the school to get riding lessons to the stables where I was riding out at the time. I had a horse. And he used to just rock up with the school. And he had one protection officer. And there were no photographers, no reporters. Of course, this was, what, the late 80s. So it's a long time ago now. But, you know, how times have changed. You know, there was just like, you know, oh, it's Prince William. But, you know, now, I fear for Prince George when he is of that age and going to prep school. You know, that I don't feel that he'll have any privacy at all.
No, so that's a celebrity age, isn't it? And I think, you know, there's so much money, and money being the driver of most things, there's so much money to be made in the right photo that the quest for it is inexorable. And also, you know, when there's that much at stake, then boundaries of decency get broken down, which is terrible. I would say that this practice of screaming obscenities at somebody until they react is technically illegal. I mean, it's a breach of the peace at the very least, if not threatening behaviour. So I wouldn't object if the police intervened and hauled some of these characters away. It's just an unpleasant scenario, isn't it, to imagine that somebody who's after all only doing their job, for which, you know, they're very well rewarded, but it's still their job, to have somebody scream obscenities at them every time they arrive to do it. Just, you shouldn't have to put up with that. You can imagine if you, you know, whatever your job might be, maybe you know, you're a joiner, and it would seem unacceptable to every time you arrived at your workshop to be a pack of people standing outside calling you an effing this and so on and so forth. And you would quite rightly expect somebody to intervene, wouldn't you?
Well, you would, but I think the practicality of it is that in a pack of photographers of, say, 20, 25 strong, to identify who in the melee is actually the person or people responsible for screaming this out, and also to expect Her Majesty's police forces to be available for every single member of anybody famous who gets caught up in this.
No, but you could make an exemplary case, couldn't you? So now and again somebody got lifted for it. I think it might tone the whole thing down. It's a terrible practice, and really shame on anybody who accepts it as part of their modus operandi. I think it's dreadful.
No surprise, of course, that it was the then Rebecca Wade who breached the protocol and published a photo of William and Catherine on the ski slope. And, of course, you know, you kind of alluded to this earlier, where this can go. I mean, this kind of led through that same newspaper to the phone hacking, and you know, which initiated, as we were reminded in the show, about Prince William's call to an aide about Tom Bradby of ITN. And, of course, that's where where the whole phone hacking thing started to unravel for the News of the World.
This is where it started to get into territory that it should have been in all the way through, because there were subtleties there which I don't think everybody was aware of. There were little nuggets in there that added to that initial phone hacking story for me, and I think, you know, that was an avenue it could well have done with exploring further with the other stories it looked at. So far too many of them were, this is what happened, with us, the viewer, going, yes, I know, I remember. It didn't manage to drill down into anything far enough to bring us anything new. But on that particular story, that's when it started to get interesting, is that how really it was Prince William who started to tear back the layers of corruption in the phone hacking scandal. That I found that very interesting, and I could have watched at least half an hour of that story being picked apart. But
I agree with you. I've got a quick question for you before we close.
Sure.
Before I ask you that, I'm just going to say the palace though never seemed to learn that the best response to bad press is to let it go. The minute you complain, you only fan the flames of the story.
Yes.
You know,
but this is what the Queen knows so well, isn't it?
Yes, she does.
Whatever brickbats she's had slung at her, and public opinion and by public opinion, we usually mean headline writers' opinion, has swung through the whole pendulum, hasn't it, during her reign, to it's time to stand down, Mom, to we'll love you forever, Mom, and back again. But her reaction has always been the same. It's stoical, poker-faced, and above it all, really. And that's clearly the most effective weapon, isn't it?
The question I want to ask you is about Prince Charles.
Oh, yeah.
And, is there a problem with Prince Charles pushing his political views? Because Steve Hewlett made reference, again, only in passing and quite towards the end of the programme, about the so-called spider letters.
Yep.
And these so-called because they're written in the terrible scribbled handwriting by the Prince of Wales to serving ministers. The Prince is thought to be left-leaning, rather like yourself, so you may have some sympathy with his views. But, you know, really, considering the situation where the monarch is thought to be non-political, yes, you know, do you have a problem with him writing spidery letters to ministers, giving them his advice on whether they should or should not be pursuing some form of action?
A spider letter does whatever a spider letter can. I do have a problem with that, in that he is using, if not abusing, the position he finds himself by accident of birth to influence public policy that is anti-democratic, and the way it is done covertly, that these are not open letters. If he was writing open letters to the papers, then I'd say, well, he's just participating in the same platform that the rest of us have available to us, that if we can put together something cohesive and intelligent enough, then a newspaper may well publish it. If we can't, we can write a blog and no for everybody to ignore. But that would be different. But to write covert letters to government departments, and on the strength of this programme, it would seem that more than one, in fact, almost every government department has received a spider letter, I think is anti-democratic. I think it's troubling, and I think he's taking unfair advantage of his position to sway government policy in a direction that he favours. That is, we did away with that with Wolf Hall, didn't we?
Well, funnily enough, yes. So, you know, there's still a bit of a ancestral line through, isn't there?
Yes, a different ancestry. But it seems that the inclination that Henry Tudor had seems to be alive and well and living with Charles Windsor, and that is problematic. Yes, it shouldn't be happening, and I can only hope that government departments treat them as curiosities and act in not swayed in any way at all, because it's an influence that you or I do not enjoy, and for Charles to enjoy it simply because he was born into a particular family does not, as I say, reflect our democratic principles at all. I don't like it.
I rather like the idea of a monarchy in the sense that, you know, of a figurehead, because I find the difficulty with republicanism, and America is the example, is that if you voted for Mitt Romney, the minute the election is finished, you've got to, if you want to be sort of patriotic or get behind your country, you've got to stand firm behind a chap that you voted against. And I think that a lot of Americans have difficulty with that. And I think it does, my view is it does add to a kind of splitting of a nation. My view is if you have a sort of benign monarchy, whether you vote for Mr. Miliband's party or Mr. Cameron's party in May, on the following day, you don't have to line up, if you wish to be patriotic, behind someone you didn't vote for, because Her Majesty the Queen is there to bind the nation together. Now, I know that's not a view that you share, but that's why I feel there's a difficulty if a member. It's not the fact that it's kind of like none of his business. It's more to the fact that when Prince Charles comes to the throne, if it becomes widely known what his political views are, that makes it terribly difficult for him to assume the position that I've just talked about.
It does, yeah. I agree entirely that. If we're going to have a monarch, it has to be a neutral monarch. Otherwise, they are just a, you know, they're just as partisan as all our other leaders. And they sort of nullify their role. I agree with that entirely. Yeah. Yeah. And we'll, this is going to unravel in an interesting way, isn't it? Because the courts, the high courts, the Supreme Court, I think, are about to rule as to whether we can see the spider letters or not. And if we can, I think there's going to be an almighty hullabaloo, which will be quite compromising for Charles. So we're on a knife edge with this, I think.
We are, and you know, I think I would have liked to have seen the programme looked a little bit more deeply into the difficulty of balancing privacy against the privilege afforded to powerful people, because you know that has led to some powerful people evading justice for heinous crimes, and you know, I think that's sort of obviously very much in our minds at the moment. But I think overall, you know, a well-made couple of programs, tightly edited, and you know, of some value to watch if you missed it and you want to catch up. This was Reinventing the Royals. It was on BBC Two on Thursday at 9 p.m. It was written and presented by Steve Hewlett, and it was directed by Paul Tilsey and Chris Walker.
And that means it's time to put the parish council back in its box, sadly, for this week. Time to shoot off. We're going to do a lot of walking, a lot of reading. In fact, you'd be surprised how much free time we actually do have. Just time to express sincere thanks to the elevated Terence Dackham.
Be seeing you.
Be seeing you. But most of all to you, our favourite listener. Thanks for being there. Until we rush to greet you again, we'll say bye-bye.
You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
move west down Ventura Boulevard, and all the bad boys are standing in the shadow, and the good girls are home with broken hearts. I'm
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.